ask Senator Brown to either find her place at the podium or join the committee, whatever suits her. Thank you very much. Senator Brown has a big role in a lot of the bills we're going to be considering today. First of all, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 229 and 234, and I'm going to put those bills over until, do you think we'll have amendments Monday? Until the Monday meeting. So 229 and 234 will be considered on Monday. Now I will open a work session on Senate Bill 232. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was before the committee on February 24th. The bill would establish the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board. The measure also provides a procedure by which youth charged with what would otherwise be a criminal offense may assert the defense of mental disease or defect and assert the defense of responsible except for insanity.
Thank you. Wendy, do you want to come up here in case people have questions? Identify yourself for the record. This is the Oregon Law Commission bill.
Madam Chair, may I just sort of fill in some background while Ms. Johnson's coming up?
I was just about to call on you, Senator Brown.
Okay.
So please do.
The simplest way I can describe this bill is that right now we have an adult system, the Psychiatric Security Review Board. What this bill establishes is a juvenile psychiatric security review board, which follows the adult model and provides for a process for juveniles who are in the system who are found responsible, i.e. guilty for crimes except for insanity. So right now the work group has studied the issues quite extensively. We had this bill in front of this committee last session. This committee passed it out. It went to Ways and Means, and we were not able to get it out of Ways and Means last time. But right now, there is no system in place to address the needs of these juveniles. We anticipate that there will be about 10 juveniles per year that will seek this process and that will be adjudicated under this process. So,
thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to put it in a terminology and in a case we all know of, if this would have been available to Kip Kinkle, what would have changed?
Senator Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't know, frankly. I don't know what I don't know what Mr. Kinkle's mental diagnosis was. I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe someone else in the audience does, but I don't know. I don't know whether Kip Kinkle would fit into the confines of this particular bill.
I think the issue is whether or not he would have been judged not guilty by reason of mental defect.
Right. Correct.
And that is the question, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, we all know that he was on Prozac or Ritalin or one of those drugs, and he had just quit taking his medication prior to committing the crimes. So because of that, I'm assuming he could have pled reason, guilty except for insanity. And like, be curious to know what would have changed in this process.
Senator Burdick, Senator Beyer, for juveniles who are able to successfully plead the defense under this bill, what would happen is two things. Number one, that they would get the treatment they are constitutionally required to get under the U.S. and state constitutions. And secondly, the public would have a level of security. It's our understanding that a portion of these kids now are under the Oregon Youth Authority system. They do not receive adequate treatment. There's another portion of these kids that are going through the dependency system, and so there is no adequate public safety response protection for some of those children. So it really depends on each juvenile's individual diagnosis and their ability to fit under the criteria of the bill. But the goal of this bill is to provide for greater public safety. I think my understanding is that both the one of the district attorneys, deputy district attorneys from Midland County, Annie Holmes Hain, has been working on this bill specifically for 4 years because of her concerns about public safety and the inability of the current system to meet those public safety needs.
Senator Byer, our counsel points out that Kip Kinkle was tried in adult court, so the technical answer to your question is it would have no impact at all, because these are this is a process for people who are tried as juveniles. Is that correct?
That's correct. Brown?
And he was indeed tried in adult court.
Would a passage of this bill, if this was available, would that have allowed him to stay in juvenile court?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, no.
Yeah. It wouldn't, because they still are adjudicated for mental defect in juvenile court. The issue is where to put them, basically. Where do they go once that adjudication has been made? And with Kip Kinkle, he was adjudicated in adult court.
One final question to
Senator Byer.
The cost, you said last session it didn't get out of Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, we have spent two interims working on the fiscal of this particular bill. Mary Claire Buckley, who is the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, said she is willing to absorb the cost through her agency of oversight of the number of juveniles coming before her, that's something she feels reasonably they can absorb in terms of costs. The fiscal is involved in two areas. It will be involved, for example, with a juvenile who's currently under Oregon Youth Authority's jurisdiction and is not accessing the appropriate level of treatment. It is also with a child who's developmentally disabled and who is not either accessing or getting any treatment under the system right now. So that's where the fiscal comes in. My understanding in talking to Gary Weeks and Bob Nickel yesterday is that the fiscal for this coming biennium, 05-07, is approximately what we had at Oz's last session, in the neighborhood of about $2 million. In the next biennium, graduates not quite exponentially, but because we anticipate about 10 juveniles per year, at the end of 3 years, for example, you probably have 30 juveniles in the system. And that's where your growth in the fiscal becomes.
Does that mean $20 million in 2005, 2007, 2009?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, I don't know. I don't recall what the numbers are for the second biennium, but it does go up. 2, 4, 6, probably 6 to 8 million.
Do we have a fiscal issued on the bill?
We have a fiscal impact statement, I believe, on this bill, and we have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And it's my understanding that we have not rescinded that. That is how it stands.
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, we have not asked to rescind that fiscal. We believe that this is an appropriate bill to be sent to Ways and Means.
Okay, and my counsel tells me that this statement is not yet issued.
Oh, it's going to Ways and Means. It probably isn't.
Correct.
Yeah.
They probably are not feeling urgent. Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick. Senator Brown, is established as responsible, except for insanity, as an affirmative defense. Since that has not been a possibility, could you be underestimating the number of people that may actually use that or try to use that defense?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we could. However, we had a number of ways, and I actually, maybe Ms. Johnson can help out here. This is part of our juvenile code work group, and we had a number of folks track and identify the number of potential juveniles that would be subject to this bill. And every method that we used to calculate, they all came up with the same number. That's 10. It's certainly also possible that we might have less than that number. We just don't know. Here we go. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, my understanding, I just received the recent fiscal from Department of Human Services for the 05-07 biennium. We have a fiscal impact of roughly $3.8 million. For the 07-09 biennium, it goes up to $12 million, not billion, sorry. It's about the same number that we agreed on the budget pie, so.
I'm just wondering why that fiscal wasn't in our materials, but another issue.
Senator Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, to add to Senator Brown's comments, the way we figured the 10 children were doubling the percentage that are successful at the adult with the adult insanity defense. We took that percentage and doubled it, looking at the number of children, a number of juveniles in the delinquency system. We took that number and doubled it. We also looked at those juveniles who might have been able to assert the defense, but just going county by county and talking to DAs about who might have been able to fit under that system, as well as judges. And every way we looked at it, it would come out to approximately 10.
Wendy, could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Senator Burdick. Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission Deputy Director. I'd also like to add, Chair Burdick, that the insanity defense is available for adults, and it's very clear in the ORS. It's also available to juveniles right now as their constitutional right. It's just that it's not defined in statute what the disposition is if the defense is successful. So any defense attorney right now can make that defense, but it's unclear to the defense attorney and the judge what happens if they're successful. And that's why we get into this, you know, hodgepodge decision-making every time, is that we want to make sure that there is public safety and there's accountability, but that the juvenile does get treatment. Regarding the finances, as Senator Brown explained, right now the bill has approximately a $2 million fiscal, but there's also about a little over $2 million that the federal government would match, assuming a 60% match. So it actually assists that part of mental health, because we would be able to receive a match, because it's not under the delinquency system. If it's mental health treatment rather than crime and adjudication side, you get a federal match.
Appreciate that clarification. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, concerns about fiscals. The other issue is that most of these juveniles are currently in the Oregon Youth Authority. We do not know whether they would continue to be placed in the Oregon Youth Authority should this bill transpire, but there would be savings by virtue of the fact, to the Oregon Youth Authority, by virtue of the fact that it's fairly unlikely these juveniles would end up at the Oregon Youth Authority. They're probably going to be in places where they will get higher level of treatment. So there is savings to the Oregon Youth Authority.
But those, it's my understanding, those have not been quantified, or will they be quantified?
Madam Chair, my recollection from our discussions with LFO is that that some of the savings were able to be quantified, but by virtue of the fact that the Oregon Youth Authority operates on, for example, they hire one staff person for 30 people. I'm just using this as an example. Don't quote me on anything. That when you reduce that number by 29, it's not going to make a difference on their ability to hire one more, you know, one staff person or not. So that the numbers are not significant, but there is some savings to the Oregon Youth Authority.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. Did you have anything to add, Wendy, before we...
No, thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Okay, I would like to send this bill on its way to Ways and Means. I'd like a sign of body language from the committee. And ideally, I would like a motion from Senator Starr. It's that the motion would be to send
move this
to
Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 232 to Ways and Means Committee.
With a due pass
recommendation, yes.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 232 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Thank you. Next, I think, Senator Brown, tell me if this is not okay with you, but I'd like to move this to a public hearing at this point on Senate Bill 921, which we haven't heard yet, and there are people with time constraints. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 921. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Take me 1 second to find the correct summary.
We have a lot of paper here today, and let me see if I can help with this project here.
I got it.
Okay.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 921 would codify that indigent parents in private adoptions would have the right to court-appointed counsel. It would also require a formalized notice and response to all parents in privately initiated adoption proceedings that are akin to those required in termination of parental rights.
Okay, it looks like we have a panel that has self-appointed, and they're all on the sign-up list, so go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm with the Oregon Law Commission. I serve as the Deputy Director. Senate Bill 921, as counsel explained, is a bill regarding the rights and procedures for parents in certain private adoption proceedings. This bill came out of the original SB 234 Putative Father Work Group, but as we worked on that bill, we determined that the relating clause wouldn't work to combine the two, and the issues were quite different, and so we decided to file Senate Bill 921. The bill does come from the Oregon Law Commission with its recommendation. There are amendments to this bill that we expect from Legislative Council any moment. These are clarifying amendments to make the bill more easy to understand, and there were a few mistakes that some of the attorneys who practice in adoption law were able to catch, so those amendments should be coming to you. In the written testimony that the Law Commission provided to you, we always show our work as in the math problems. You should receive a report that's entitled Juvenile Code Revision Work Group. It was prepared by myself, and at the bottom you'll see that it was approved by the Law Commission on February 17th. That report explains in summary fashion what the bill does. It also explains the history. It explains the problems that this bill seeks to address, and it goes through the bill section by section. I'm going to leave the details of the bill to the folks to my left, but I will just highlight from the summary of the report that this bill would require a petitioner in certain private adoption proceedings to serve a summons with a motion in order to show cause on the both parents who do not consent to the adoption. The goal is to get consent for this adoption or to dispense with the need from consent because the parent doesn't object or the parent doesn't show up so that we can move along towards adoption. Presently, there's an outmoded citation process, and so switching to the summons process will make it easier for attorneys and provide better notice to these parents. Next, the bill also codifies the substantive right to court-appointed counsel. This is these private adoptions are occurring in family court as opposed to juvenile proceedings, as most of Senator Brown's bills. But the effect is the same. You're terminating a parent's rights in either juvenile court or in family court. And so the right to court-appointed counsel is the same. There's a Oregon Supreme Court case that holds that the effect is the same, and so the rights are the same. So the bill codifies that Oregon Supreme Court case regarding right to counsel, so everyone is on notice that these parents have right to counsel as well. And lastly, the bill just puts a procedure in statute, including a form, so that everybody's on notice of what the process is for these private adoptions when you're terminating a parent's parental rights. So with that, if I'll take any questions, and I'll turn the need explanation for the need for this bill to the folks to my left, Scott Adams and Sybil Hebb.
Thank you very much. You can decide who goes next.
Sybil, go ahead.
Sybil, go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm the legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center, and we're here today to urge support of this bill. As you know, the Law Center provides civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians, and so it's from that particular perspective that we are supportive and from which we speak. As Wendy explained, Senate Bill 921 addresses privately initiated adoption proceedings in circuit family court as opposed to adoption proceedings initiated by the state in juvenile court. And it basically brings the practices that are required in juvenile court into the circuit court proceedings. And it basically codifies what is current law decided by the Supreme Court in 1990. The reason that we're particularly supportive of this bill is that it as Wendy detailed, provides specific notice to indigent parents that they are entitled to a court-appointed attorney. And as we discussed, that is, in fact, the current law, but most indigent parents do not know that when they're going through a circuit court adoption proceeding, and they are generally not informed of that until they show up at court at a hearing. And many times that drags the process out and involves unnecessary court expense, as the judge is then required to let the indigent parent know what his or her rights might be, and then if the parent chooses to elect to take advantage of those rights and to ask for an attorney, then the hearing has to be set over and the process is delayed. So this bill will provide that notice at the outset and allow the parent the opportunity to avail himself of that right prior to the court hearing, which provides for greater efficiency. As well, we're supportive of the bill because it provides a specific and very, we feel, user-friendly form that will be provided and is meant to be served on parents. And that form is easy to read, and it's easy for parents to elect whether or not they want to respond, whether or not they consent to the adoption, and whether or not they would like an attorney. And it provides them with specific information about how to avail themselves of that process. So again, I stress that this bill, in our perspective, nearly codifies what is current law according to the Supreme Court and makes the law more accessible to people, which doesn't impose an added cost on the court. It merely speeds up the process and adds to the court efficiency. So, thanks.
Thank you very much. And I don't see anybody from the courts here waving their arms, so I assume that's the case. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Senator Burdick, Senators, Council, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Scott Adams. I'm a sole practitioner in the adoption field. Adoptions is 75 to 80% of my practice. So 109330 that we're talking about amending here and the related statutes is something that I live every day. I would like to bring a little bit of a practical how this would affect us out in the field view to the senators today. And would like to respond very initially quickly to Senator Burdick's comment about the judges are not here standing raising their arms. In fact, I believe Judge McKnight has submitted testimony in writing on this, and Judge Cobb out of Washington County has been all over this from day one because this is so important. As those judges understand the rights of predominantly putative fathers, or fathers that come before them whose rights may be terminated, Ms. Hebb and I were talking, it's about 70%, 75% of these cases in my practice are actually the fathers whose rights are being asked to be terminated. But the judges throughout our state don't do many adoptions in the private realm. And where this generally comes into play is a step-parent adoption. The bulk of the adoptions that are covered by this are a step-parent adoption. And the judges just don't understand that if somebody comes up that Zockert v. Fanning says they have a right to counsel because their rights may be terminated. The other thing that the judges don't understand is the current requirements of 109330 and what to do with the citation and order. And I believe that maybe some of the senators may not even know what that is. We all know that a summons is you have 30 days to respond. And if you don't respond, they're going to take action against you adverse to your rights. A citation is show up at the court on this date to give the court evidence why your rights shouldn't be terminated. It doesn't tell that parent that they have a time frame, that they could file a written answer. It doesn't tell them that they have a right to counsel because their rights are going to be terminated. It doesn't give them any options on what to do other than show up. What practically happens, most of the time they don't show up. But the courts have to set this hearing date right now. So they set that hearing date, and they set it for a 5 to a 10 minute block. The parents that do show up say, I want to object to this adoption, or I want counsel, if they know enough to say that, or if the judges know enough to tell them that, you know, they then say, okay, well, we'll reset this hearing for a future date. That's obviously taken up a lot of court's time for those cases where a father, in our example, or a parent may not object, where under the summons process, they have the standard 30 days to respond. If they don't do that, or if they don't send something back, then a default can be taken without having the court have to have set that hearing time aside, as well as a default is only taken against them with their full knowledge of what their rights were. Currently, we don't have to tell them what their rights are. We just tell them to show up. The juvenile court has been required to use the summons process. Every other part of our civil litigation that I'm aware of uses the summons process. This is the one sole remaining citation show cause order that doesn't include the summons process. So seeing this requires us on the practical side to include quite a bit more information in the notices that we're serving on a non-consenting parent. And it is more difficult and more costly for the private petitioner. And most of the time that will be more costly in the way of preparing a few more documents. However, they're not going to have to pay me to go to court to sit there in case the person shows up. So there is a cost savings that way. This is not adding any rights that don't already exist. This is not adding any more court time. It's subtracting court time. And this is not changing the classification of the people who are required to receive notice. All it's doing is saying if you're going to give somebody notice, you have to give them full and complete notice of what all the rights are. And because of that, the judges, the attorneys that I practice with, we all stand in favor of it. I would like to suggest, as I have in my testimony that's been handed out, that I have a concern about those cases where we have to publish for the non-consenting parent. In a step-parent adoption, maybe 20% of my adoptions, the clients come to me, and the parent has just disappeared. They've been out of the children's life for at least a year by statute, but more practically, it's 5 to 10 years or more. And this family would like to establish some permanency in the family that they are now, the step family. And under the publication, currently we have to publish the single-page citation. That runs between $300 and $500, depending on what newspaper we have to publish in. If we have to publish all of this additional information, I'm concerned about the cost that that might add. I could see publication bills being upwards of $1,500, and I can see a lot of my clients not being able to do that. I would suggest that there may be an ability to have an amendment that says, in the case of publication, which many of us recognize is a fiction because the likelihood of finding somebody after we have sent private investigators after them, after we have done a due diligence search to try and find this person, the likelihood of finding someone because it showed up in Willamette Week is pretty weak. But I'd suggest that in the publication cases, after we've already proven to the court that a private investigator can't find this person, that online searches can't find this person, that this person has literally disappeared from this family, that in those cases we'd be able to provide the right to counsel, the options to opt out, the other options that are spectacular in this bill once they or if they appear. But with that sole exception, this bill is spectacular in that it will make everything the same throughout the court systems, be understandable to the judges, be a little bit more burden on us in the practical field, but I feel as a attorney who represents birth parents, that difficulty is well worth it because the birth parents will now understand what rights they have.
Appreciate your comments. By the way, for the record, my comment about the courts waving their hands was strictly in relation to the fiscal comment and not the substance. We all received a letter from Maureen McKnight, and it's a very articulate statement of support for this bill. I wanted to, on your comment about the publication, I wanted to run that by Ms. Johnson and see what you're off the cuff, and also Senator Brown. Maybe Senator Brown, you'd like to comment first, what you think of that. You're talking, I assume, about an abbreviated publication, not a non-publication, but an abbreviated.
Absolutely. The publication requirement is still going to exist. We have to give these parents every last chance. I just worry about having to publish 4 or 5 pages of information as opposed to 1.
Correct. So, Wendy, did you have a comment on that?
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission. Senator Burdick, members of the committee, this issue regarding publication is a new issue. I haven't discussed it with the commission or the work group. It's something that we can consider perhaps later. It's an issue that would also seem to be at issue in the juvenile court, because rarely the juvenile court also has to use publication as a method of service. It's something that we could look at. It's a two-edged sword, though, because it's important to get, we stand behind this bill, and it's important to get the notice to these absent parents, and so to provide less notice because it's publication and because it's expensive is a policy matter. It's tough for me to just talk off the cuff on it without talking to the work group and the commission as well.
Maybe you could do that and get back with us.
And Senator, the work group has been wonderful to talk about those issues. And let me clarify my position as a private practitioner. I would much rather see this bill go into effect as it is right now, even requiring me to publish all of that, with the opportunity to adjust it later, if we can't adjust it before it would go through passage now, then I would see that issue hold up this bill. Having these rights is too important, as the commission has decided.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Brown, do you have any comments or questions?
I don't, actually, on this particular bill, other than it makes sense. It may make sense to go further, but this looks very appropriate.
Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. We have nobody else signed up. So we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 921. And I'm halfway tempted to open a work session, Senator Brown, on this bill if you wanted to move it and deal with this issue in the other chamber.
Senator Burdick, I'd just like to add that the amendments haven't quite made it here yet. So before
I'm missing amendments.
Before
you
pass.
That's right. You did mention that at the beginning. I apologize.
Okay.
I'm getting over eager. Okay. Okay. The amendments actually are on their way. I'm always reluctant to pass something out when we just get the amendments, so we probably will hold this to another day. Okay. Now we have, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 231. I'm sorry. Yeah. Isn't that the one? Yeah. 231. Okay. Did you want to do 233 first?
No.
Okay.
I am here at your convenience.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to... excuse me. I withdraw that work session. We are opening a work session on Senate Bill 230. I made a bad note on my thing.
Okay.
Got confused. We are now in work session on Senate Bill 230. And, Senator Brown, we will open this work session by asking you to define the term ad litem. We had quite a discussion in the hearing.
Senator Burdick, I don't have a clue.
Can we give you the definition?
That'd be great.
It actually is Latin for the case.
Case by case. Okay. Very interesting.
For the case.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, if I just make a couple of comments on the bill, I probably can't answer specific details of the bill. It's just been my experience working in juvenile court, and I have not practiced, thankfully, for a period of time, 5 or 6 years now, but it's been my experience that appointments of guardian ad litems are fairly commonplace in juvenile court, because there are a number of parents involved in the juvenile court system that are development delayed, don't have the mental capacity to provide minimally adequate parenting, and then also don't have that same ability to provide to make decisions for themselves in juvenile court. So it's fair to say, I think, that this is a fairly common circumstances, and I think the issue that's before you is that the guardian ad litems themselves want to have clarification about what their role is in juvenile court in terms of representing these parents. It's just a wide open, there are no parameters, and I think it's very frustrating, speaking as one who's been a guardian ad litem, about what your role is to be in these juvenile court dependency cases. So
Thank you for that. Council, I'll give you a chance first to see if there's anything you wanted to add or describe the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. There is a dash one amendment that I think was before us, possibly at the public hearing, but just in case it was not. What it does is it specifies the duties of the guardian ad litem. The original version of the bill had a general reference to that the guardian ad litem would have the duties to make the decisions the parent would otherwise make, and the dash one amendment actually lists out the major decisions. The other thing that the amendment does is that it makes clear that the guardian ad litem is to, that the parent's attorney is to follow the directions of the guardian ad litem as if they were the parent. So these are clarifying amendments. I also will point out that there was discussion of another amendment that I brought up at the time of the public hearing, because the hearing on deciding whether or not to appoint a guardian ad litem in the terms of the bill says that the evidence code does not apply. I pointed out that for consistency's sake, it may be wise to also amend the portion of the evidence code that makes it clear there's a preamble to the evidence code that says the evidence code applies in all cases except blah blah blah, and I suggested listing this in that section. That was put to LC, and I spoke to Virginia Vanderbilt this morning. Her opinion is that would not be necessary because there are two other places in the juvenile code where similar references are made, and those references are not in the preamble to the Oregon Evidence Code. The two examples are when a juvenile applies for relief from sex offender registration, and the other is shelter hearings. Okay. So LC doesn't think it's necessary, and it was just a spur-of-the-moment suggestion on my part.
Okay. Just on the ball, our council. Thank you. Wendy, did you have anything you wanted to add on Senate Bill 230?
Members of the committee, again, my name is Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. I serve as the deputy director. This bill had a full hearing just a few weeks ago. You heard from both a guardian ad litem and a juvenile attorney who works with these juvenile court ad litems. And this bill really is about helping the parent who is not able to assist, and it gives direction to the guardian as well as the attorney. Many times these guardian ad litems are attorneys who have ethical obligations to follow, and it's really a comfort level right now that the code is just very silent on what the role of a guardian ad litem is in these cases. And it just details that out following Court of Appeals and Supreme Court case law, as well as just working out the practicalities of what happens in these cases. So we feel it's a consensus bill that's a good bill.
Thank you very much. Senator Barr, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I've got at least one. I was curious why the rules of evidence don't apply at a hearing.
Senator Beyer, I think that can I rephrase? Can I clarify? Is your question why would the rules of evidence not apply at a hearing on whether to appoint a guardian ad litem? Is that the question?
That's the question.
I think that might be better for the commission. I can speculate that it would not apply, or as a policy matter, that the court might not want them to apply because this is sort of a preliminary finding, much like whether someone is able to aid and assist in a criminal case. And it can be problematic for the parties to call live witnesses that involve psychologists and psychiatrists and mental health professionals so as to meet the rules of evidence with respect to hearsay. That's my guess, my speculation.
That's a good one.
That's Mayor? Pretty good. Please do, Senator.
Yeah. The legislature has given a policy decision in certain areas where the rules of evidence don't apply. And I was just wanting to get the citation. It's ORS 40.1 015, and it says the applicability of the evidence code, and it just basically walks through and says where it applies. Many of the times where it doesn't apply, it's either because it is a preliminary issue that's not really before a jury. The judge is, we've taken a position that we think a judge is able to make a decision without having the safeguards of the rules of evidence in place to actually be in play, like if you would with a jury. And determination as to whether someone is, I think on the criminal area, some areas like whether something's going to be admissible as evidence, the rules of evidence don't apply there. Whether someone qualifies for, I guess, into the diversion, I think all of those are different examples. It's just a policy decision that we're not going to require the more strict, rigid application of the rules of evidence in these more preliminary one-on-one with the court, I guess is what I would say. And I don't know if this would help, but we can walk through some of this stuff as to some different places where they've said it doesn't apply.
Okay, no, but and maybe I've got this thing wrong, but when you're taking away parental rights, it seems to me like that's a pretty big issue.
To clarify, I don't think that this means that I don't think there's anything in the bill that says the rules of evidence do not apply in the termination of parental rights proceeding. It is only the preliminary proceeding that's set out in this bill to determine whether or not the parent should be appointed a guardian ad litem. And I see Mr. Travis coming to my rescue.
A new witness here. Welcome, Mr. Travis. Can you shed some light on this?
And Madam Chair, and Mr. Travis obviously has more direct experience than I do, but I would just note that in this particular circumstances where you have this particular parent, there are two, the guardian ad litem adds a layer of protection, and then you have the attorney as well. So there's essentially two layers of protection for this particular client. You may not think of a lawyer as being a layer of protection, but I think in terms of protecting the client's rights, the lawyer does provide protections. I don't know, Mr. Travis, do you want to add something?
Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department. There are many questions that are faced by the juvenile court where the evidence code does not apply.
Right.
As a matter of fact, it is mostly for the purpose of keeping the formality of the proceeding down and providing for the entrance of hearsay evidence into the proceeding. This particular issue, this particular question of whether there's a guardian ad litem, has nothing to do with terminations of parental rights. The guardian ad litem is not allowed to relinquish the parent's rights for them. And attorneys are very, and guardians ad litem are very squirrely about doing things like that. This is merely to prevent, in the case of proving that a guardian ad litem is necessary, bringing in the psychologists, the psychologist, and the psychiatrists, and a lot of witnesses to swear to this, that, and the other thing on the witness stand and to have a formal proceeding. This is a really touchy thing because what happens here is if I'm representing a parent, I'm a lawyer, and I'm representing a parent, and I believe that the parent is unable to help me represent this parent's interest. That's the situation that we're facing here. So I don't want to put on a trial with psychologists and psychiatrists to prove to the judge that my client isn't capable of aiding and assisting, if you will, in a sort of an analogy to a criminal case. So that's what's going on here. It's mostly for the convenience of allowing hearsay documents and things like that to come before the judge to decide without calling the witnesses. And we do this in disposition in juvenile court. We do it at shelter hearings in juvenile court. We do it in juvenile court in every aspect of the case except when we are specifically finding facts which bring someone within the jurisdiction of the court or which terminate someone's parental rights, and then the evidence code definitely does apply and all the formalities of the courtroom apply.
Well, Madam Chair, yes, I would somewhat disagree if I as a parent is disagreeing with my attorney as to what should be happening to my child. My attorney can then go ask for a guardian ad litem and claim that I'm not capable of making a correct decision what's right for my child. So they're going to bring somebody else in as another layer.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the bill requires that you have to set, you have to have a motion that set forth facts that establish that it is more probable than not that the parent, due to mental or physical disability, lacks substantial capacity to either understand the nature and consequences of the proceedings or give direction and assistance to the parent's attorney on decisions that the parents must make. Let me give you two circumstances. I represented a young woman who was just charming, who definitely had a developmental disability, but she clearly understood. She could direct me as her attorney in terms of what she wanted to do. She understood the consequences of her actions, i.e. not going to her parenting classes, that would heighten her risk of losing her children, versus another client I had who had schizophrenia, and I never knew, I had no knowledge whether she understood all of the time the ramifications of her actions. And that's two very different circumstances. The young woman with the developmental disability, I knew very clearly that she was able to understand the consequences. The other young woman with the mental illness, I don't know. And that probably should have been a case where she had a guardian ad litem so that I wasn't forced to make those decisions to wrestle with those issues.
It's actually a protection for the parent.
I can see that's one way to look at it, but also if the rules of evidence don't apply at the hearing when they're determining whether or not there's a guardian ad litem needed, it seems to me that the parent can get a railroad job.
But the guardian can't make the decision.
If I may.
Please, Senator Pazansky.
The judge is, he or she is going to sit and make that judgment, and when you have more of a relaxed setting and you don't have the formality and the rigidness of it, it allows he or she to maybe take in more information than what the rules would permit. Because if you say hearsay can't come in except for certain exceptions, there may not be a way of getting that information before the judge, and it may be beneficial. And I would assume this probably has been considered as a policy to be more beneficial for the judge, for he or she to have that information before they make that decision, whether that individual should have someone appointed to represent their rights. And if you go more on formality, then the judge may have to put those blinders on and say, if it can't come through one of these exceptions, I can't hear it, I don't know it. It's awkward to try to describe. I mean, I looked here, I was going to give you some examples of where else it doesn't apply, but I don't know if it would really help. I mean, it's like sentencing and in the criminal proceeding and grand jury. There are things where you're outside of the issue of asking for a warrant where you don't have to have that formality and rigidness, and the judge, he or she, either is going to be receiving more information and we've taken a policy and think that the judge and their capacity can filter through what they are hearing as compared to in a more formal setting, especially with a jury, they may not be able to take and make those distinctions and needing to have much more checks and balances. And I have never done juvenile work, but what I understand, and Mr. Travis, is that in that situation, you're looking at trying to make certain that the judge gets all the information that he or she can get, with the understanding that there are a couple type of proceedings that are going to have long-lasting outcomes, such as losing their right to custodialship, parentship, that you find that the court is much more open to hearing everything, except in those very limited areas as compared to in the criminal or in the civil area.
That's correct. The idea.
Let me try something here.
I just want to add, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, this is already happening now in juvenile court. Guardian ad litems are being appointed for parents who are unable to assist their attorneys. What this bill does is provide some guidance to the people who are going to be the guardian ad litem as to what their specific obligations and role is in terms of the client, what the limits on that relationship are, because as Ms. Johnson mentioned, mentioned earlier, many of these folks are attorneys, and so there's a different ethical professional responsibility to the client. So it's a different relationship. More of a, well, I don't want to say that, fiduciary. But anyway, it's already happening now. This bill provides parameters. Does that help?
Actually, that does help because it really tightens up and clarifies what a guardian ad litem can do and makes it very clear that they can't make decisions, et cetera. It does not, what I'm hearing from you is it doesn't change in any way the application of the evidence code to
That's
these
correct.
Decisions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what you're I'd have to ask them why that specific provision is new language. Section 2 says 4, that new language being proposed to the statute, so if that's already law, why are we putting it into law?
Senator Beyer, that this whole proceeding about appointment of guardians ad litem is new in the sense that this is the first time it's going into the statutes. Throughout the juvenile code, you will find for each different kind of hearing, there is a provision in the statutes that describe that hearing which lay out how the evidence code is applied within that particular kind of hearing. This language, this quote-unquote new language, is in here because the entire proceeding is coming into the code for the very first time. So in the section on adjudications, it talks about the evidence code applies. In the section on dispositions, it talks about how it does and doesn't apply. In the part about review hearings, this is just a new hearing that's being added, and like all kinds of hearings, there's a specific provision in that hearing to tell you how the evidence code applies or doesn't apply so that there's not a question, so that it's not unmentioned how the evidence code applies. Because if you don't mention it, it's presumed that it does apply.
Well, if it's a new proceeding, but it's already happening, where is the statutory authority for it to be happening now?
That's an embarrassing question to ask, Senator.
I think that's the nut of the...
That is why it's before you today. The juvenile code does not have a provision to do this specifically. The juvenile code has a wide equitable power. Within the juvenile code, in so many words, it says that the juvenile court has powers of equity to do what is in the best interest of the child. And that's a big cow from which a lot of milk can be drawn. Okay? And that's how it's been done with these, is under that broad power. But the reason that we want a specific piece of legislation now is to make sure that how can I go with that analogy? That the cows milk the same way everywhere. One of the things that this bill does, for example, is this bill prohibits a relative from being the guardian ad litem for the parent who is the subject of this. That's so that you can't have a family manipulation situation where a grandparent, the parent of the parent, takes over and runs their own child's life. The guardian ad litem has to be a disinterested third person. Okay? And that's been a hassle in juvenile court in these guardians ad litem situation. Who can be the guardian ad litem? Because we want it to be an arm's length situation. Because that guardian ad litem is going to be instructing the lawyer what to do. If the lawyer's client is deemed to need a guardian ad litem, that doesn't mean the lawyer gets to do what he or she wants to do with the case. The example you brought up earlier where the lawyer supposedly disagrees with the client. The lawyer's still taking their orders from a disinterested third party. That's not the lawyer that's going to make the decisions from then on. And that guardian ad litem also has a duty to sort of figure out if the parent comes back into competency, if you will, to call this whole show off. Because we have things like depression, which are conditions which assail parents in juvenile court. And they can be disabled for 6 to 8 months, but they can also regain their ability. But that's sort of drifted off from why we're putting this in now. But all these things are not governed. We don't have, and lawyers are in a heck of a spot. Because as Senator Brown said, when you're representing one of these people, you don't know what to do. Because are you supposed to do what you think they want you to do? Are you supposed to do what you think is in their best interest, ethically? So what you want as a lawyer is you want someone whose job is to stand in their shoes and instruct you as to what you're supposed to do. And that's what this is about.
You're right, he shouldn't have said that, because the next question would be, so this is another case where this is what's happening, and you want a statutory authority to do what you're already doing?
It's under a different scenario. It's under an inherent power. The court has power and equity because it sits not only under rule but also in common good, and that's how this has been done. What they're trying to do is go ahead and put it in the statutes that this is something that instead of being done in equity, it's going to be done under statute.
It's going to be rules for how it's done rather than...
More parameters on it.
Rather than people making it up as they go along.
So right now, are you finding situations where grandparents are coming in as guardians ad litem?
That's happened in the past. I don't think it's happening now, but 10 to 15 years ago, it was a problem when I was practicing.
Go ahead,
sir. That gets into the next question I had, is that, you know, that's one of the questions I had. Why can't it be a member of the family? What's wrong with a grandparent or a brother or someone? You know, I would think that would maybe a good avenue.
Conflicts of interest. Conflicts of interest, for example, it may not occur commonly, but the family dynamics in juvenile court cases can be a thicket. For example, the parent who is a mother could be someone who has been resisting parental control all of her life, and at last, grandmother thinks that if she becomes the guardian ad litem, she can finally control her child's life. I mean, these are the kinds of family dynamics that go on in juvenile court at times. It's the same thing with the intervention statutes. You get people who want to intervene. You know, grandparents can be good forces in a juvenile court case, and grandparents can be not so good forces in a juvenile court case. And when you're having somebody who's a guardian ad litem, you want them to be arm's length kind of people and not people who may or may not have their own emotional familial agendas.
And that certainly wouldn't rule out an outcome that was favorable to the grandparent if there was
certainly
a
not.
Dispute. Is that correct? I mean, if it was in the best interest of the child.
Well, under this bill, it says it may not be a member of the parent's family.
Right. But still, the grandparent who has an interest in the case, in the outcome of the case, could still, you know, make a case for what's in the best interest of the child. Is that correct?
Simply because a grandparent can't be a guardian ad litem doesn't mean a grandparent couldn't end up as the guardian of the child.
I think that's maybe the confusion here.
We're
not going to allow the person who potentially could become the guardian
correct.
Of the children to make the decisions for their child, the grandmother, so she's the grandmother, come in and say, my daughter can't do this, I'm going to make these decisions. Oh, by the way, I should be the guardian of these children. And having someone that's disinterested making the decisions that's best for the parent who is not capable of making those decisions for mental capacity issues or whatever it is, they're going to be dispassionately, we hope or we believe, to make decisions that are most appropriate for that parent. And it does not conflict, as Mr. Travis has said, for someone else who may end up being the conservator or the guardian of the child in question. That's the part of that conflict in interest. It's not that it's going to prohibit them from being appointed by the court. If they think in the best interest of the child, the grandparent, the grandmother should be the guardian of the child, but they're not going to let the grandmother make the decision on the part of the daughter as to, I should be that one because I'm making it because my daughter would want me to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
The guardian ad litem for the parent is a different person than the guardian for the child.
I understand, but, well, my understanding is that these proceedings are for to try to figure out what is best for the child.
That's correct.
So it's not like the grandmother or grandfather or the relative could come in and say, I want to be guardian ad litem and I want to be guardian of the child, because the court still has to determine what's best for the child. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. But if they're the guardian ad litem for the parent, they're disqualified as the guardian for the child because there's a conflict of interest.
And so the grandparent who wants to, let's say the end result is to take care of the child as the guardian, will be able to advocate for that duty, but they will not be able to stand in as the guardian ad litem of the parent to reach that goal.
This is for cases where the parent is incapable, in the judgment of the court, of exercising their own rights. This is the guardian ad litem is for the parent, because these are termination proceedings.
No, I understand that.
And so if you have a parent who is incapable of participating in their own interest, then they need someone who can do their best from an objective standpoint to determine what the parent wants, what the parent's interests are, without regard to the child or the anything else, just the parent, to make sure that their rights are not abrogated in the proceeding. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I don't know if you want to just move on with this, Madam Chair. I mean, I still got questions about it.
Madam Chair, I guess I don't think this is something that you're planning on moving based on the lack of committee members and everything. Maybe it would be worth having someone meet with Senator Beyer and maybe walk through some of that to give him more comfort. I mean, I'll be glad to sit down with you, Roger, and go through it as best I can, but maybe someone that actually has the juvenile experience can give you that story, which I can only do from a third person. I've never been in a juvenile court to practice, but a lot of this stuff, I know, I mean, in school, it's one of those things, you know, what is this, what's that? And so maybe having someone that can actually help facilitate that will give you a better understanding. And if you have other questions, we should bring up the people and have it.
And we can provide.
I would encourage you to do that, Senator Barr, because I think from the tone of your questions, I think you're very concerned about the parents' rights here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this bill is supposed to address. So I would encourage you to meet with them, and we can close the work session now on this and bring it back when you've had a chance to talk in more detail line by line. And Senator Pruszynski, I appreciate your willingness to work on this as well.
And Senator Beyer, I'm not sure if you know, Mr. Travis actually in a previous life was very involved in juvenile rights, and you may want to give your...
I was an attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. I represented parents and children in dependency and in termination cases, as well as kids in delinquency cases. We can provide you with some fresh faces to talk about this.
And it definitely is my intent to move this bill at some point, but we will delay that for a couple days. You probably get your questions answered by Monday. Maybe we'll put this one over to Monday with the other ones that we're carrying over to Monday. So we will carry Senate Bill 230 over until Monday's meeting, and this work session is closed. Okay, next we will move to, we've got, let's see. I think we can move through these fairly quickly. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 231. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 231 would require the juvenile court to create lists identifying records that have been provided to the court but were not admitted as exhibits. These are known as the social file, typically. The Dash 1 amendment, which is in your packet, I believe, as well, ought to be a hand engrossed copy of the bill, hopefully, is there. Incorporates the Dash 1 amendment, and the Dash 1 amendment makes clear that district attorneys, assistant attorneys general, juvenile departments, Oregon Youth Authority, Department of Human Services, all have access to that material and are able to share that material. This is cast at our public hearing on this on the 24th by the Department of Justice as a cleanup bill. And since the time of the public hearing, I think we've gotten that there is no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, would you care to issue some very brief comments on this?
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson again from the Oregon Law Commission for the record. As the committee council explains, this is a cleanup bill regarding juvenile records. It basically does three things, and those three things are outlined in the report. But it makes clear that transcripts are confidential. It
says who can get a hold of these records, that it was not clear in the record that all the parties were entitled to receive copies of these records, so it includes the district attorneys, the assistant attorney general, DHS, OA, all those, the parties that are necessary to the case. And it also makes it clear that the courts are responsible to make sure that the record is clear for appeal of what materials were reviewed by the court. Doesn't mean the court has to store them. It just says that it needs to be provided for, and that's how we don't have the courts waving their arms, as the chair alluded to earlier. It allows flexibility, but it does require a list of what was relied upon for the order. So those are the three things that this bill does.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Senator Stark, would you have a motion on this Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 231?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 231.
Senator Stark has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 231. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Stark?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 231 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 231 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this bill?
I can do that.
Thank you, Senator Walker. We will now close the work session on Senate Bill 231 and open a work session on Senate Bill 233. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 233 is the Oregon Youth Authority cleanup bill, and at our public hearing on the 24th, we heard from Timothy Travis and Karen Andahl from the Oregon Youth Authority and the Oregon Judicial Department, respectively. This essentially is a bill that makes multiple amendments to the juvenile code that reflect that the delinquency code is guided by the principles of public safety, accountability, and reformation, as opposed to the principles guiding the dependency code. And this bill came out of essentially changes that were overdue, according to the Oregon Law Commission, when the juvenile code was split into different sections.
Ms. Johnson, do you have any comments on this one?
Thank you, Senator Riddick, members of the committee. Again, my name is Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. I would just add that the Dash 2 amendments just finished the project when this bill was initially pre-session filed, but the work wasn't quite finished. The report that you received at the hearing addresses those amendments. The commission has approved those amendments. They just carry out the rest of the project. This bill does focus on OAA and their the reports that OAA is required to file, as well as the review hearings that OAA handles.
Okay, we are. Are we just dealing with the Dash 2 amendments here, or do we have a help?
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments incorporate both the Dash 1 and the new amendments, so the Dash 2 amendments are all that we need.
Okay, great. Thank you. Is there questions? Senator Walker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I thought I had that with me. I've been carting it around for a couple of days. I'm really concerned about what's going on at the Oregon Youth Authority right now. I think I talked to you about that yesterday. This seems like a relevant bill to have a conversation because it modifies what the Oregon Youth Authority case planning for youth offender must ensure. I would think that it must ensure that our children are protected from pedophile case workers who endanger their lives. And I kind of think I want to hold on to this bill and do some work. Unless you have another idea.
Yeah, Senator Walker, I share your concern. I've made a commitment to take up this issue. We're still discussing how. We have an abundance of relating clauses and bills and assorted things in this committee, and you can count on serious consideration of the issues. So I would like to move this bill along in its current form. I think it's a worthy bill. I think the other discussion deserves a very serious discussion in its own domain.
Okay, I will acquiesce to that with that assurance that we will have a full discussion about Mr. Boyles in that case and what the hell is going on over there, frankly. I'm just appalled.
Thank you. Senator Starr, do you have a motion on the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 233.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 233. Is there discussion? Are there objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 233 as amended. The floor is the DPAS recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 233 as amended to the Senate floor with a DPAS recommendation. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this one as well as our Law Commission ambassador?
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Work session's closed on Senate Bill 233. And now our next subject, we will switch gears here into the criminal justice area. And we will open...
No problem.
Do we?
We have 547 and 548.
Right. I wonder if we should hear those together.
I think it makes sense.
I think we're going to hear, we're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 547 and Senate Bill 548. We'll hear those two together.
Together?
Yes. Open the public hearing. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 547 would expand the crime of criminal impersonation of a police officer. There's a Dash 1 amendment in your packet, and that makes pretty substantial changes to the original language. It inserts a mental state that would require proof that the defendant acted with intent to obtain a benefit or to injure or defraud another person, and it also adds to the definition of law enforcement uniform. So the bottom line is that, as amended, this would make it a Class C felony to use either false law enforcement identification, that's current law, or to use a law enforcement uniform as defined in the statute in order to defraud another person or with intent to obtain benefit or injure another person.
Okay. Why don't we call up Gina Skinner, Dan Swift, and Brian DeLashnet. Brian's only signed up for one of these, but is he even here?
He left about 5 minutes ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed. I didn't let you summarize the second bill. So while you're standing by, counsel will summarize the second bill. Thank you.
The second bill is Senate Bill 548. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senate Bill 548 modifies the crime that's already on the books, which is interfering with a police officer. It would delete language that was held unconstitutional in State versus Illig Wren, the citation of which is in the staff summary. And that portion is that it is a misdemeanor offense of interfering with peace officer, if the person, knowing the other person is a peace officer, refuses to obey a lawful order. That is the section that was struck down under Article 1, Section 8, speech issues. This bill would delete that section. This bill would also add, though, two other new sections that would apply. A person would be interfering with a peace officer under the new statute if they were intentionally or knowingly remaining in a designated crime scene without permission of the peace officer, or if they were intentionally interfering with a peace officer who was lawfully engaged in an investigation or a of a crime or a traffic collision.
Thank you. And before we get to our panel, I'd like to offer, if you would like, Senator Kozanski, a chance to make any comments you wanted to make on these bills. These are both your bills.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chairman. What I would say is that on 547, and it really was a work that came about through the City of Eugene Police Commission, which I'm a member of. There is a handout that came out just now from our committee staff from the commission as to how we, let's say, got to the point where we thought there needed to be some changes. I think you're going to hear from at least one of the speakers today how this will apply in other situations besides a confusion between two agencies, and I use the term agency loosely, where one is actually sworn officers and the other is not sworn officers. Specifically, as the memo from the police commission makes reference to, We had a situation, we still have a situation where you could have private security officers or you could have campus university officers who may be dressed in very similar uniform attire that could cause confusion and has in fact caused confusion where people think they're actually dealing with sworn police officers, and sworn police officers actually in the night think they have maybe backup when they really don't have backup there because it's someone else. That was how it came up, and when you look at the existing statute, the only thing that is at this point really covered is where you're talking about badge or identification, and clearly we have seen in other situations, I expect you'll hear today, where a uniform or, let's say, clothing could, in fact, cause someone to believe that they're dealing with law enforcement when, in fact, they're not. That's the 547. On Senate Bill 548, as counsel said, there was a recent court decision that basically threw out a portion of that statute. This bill originally was passed, if I'm not mistaken, back in 1997. Mm-hmm. As a bill that I brought forward. We had added what was sub B, which is refused to obey a lawful order of a peace officer because of constitutional protections of individuals. The Court of Appeals ruled that that section was broad and was in violation of or could violate someone's protected rights. And we have dash ones for both of these. Regarding the dash ones on 548, unfortunately, this was, I asked LC to do this very quickly, and unfortunately, they left off a portion. My staff has sent down, and we're going to end up having a dash two, which actually includes part of the concerns the court had, and Mr. Swift, Trooper Swift, will be able to give us a little bit more information about that.
I appreciate that, Senator Prudensky. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can you identify yourself for the record? Thank you.
My name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County, Oregon, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association in favor of both Senate Bill 547 and 548. I'll keep my comments brief as far as 547. Senator Prudensky has most eloquently expressed the purposes behind this bill. The association is in favor of it. In addition to the confusion and the limitations that having to require a badge versus a uniform can have, I think that that is problematic and too limited. But generally, the District Attorney Association wants people in the community to be able to respect people that they believe are police and to comply with police orders. And too often now, I think we see on these TV shows these extreme examples of people finding out that somebody that's following them is really not a police officer. And so citizens have this heightened fear that they shouldn't pull over or they shouldn't comply with an order because they're in fear. And I think by broadening this in the manner in which it is in this bill, it will give the citizens, again, that satisfaction of knowing that we will enforce criminal action at the level of a felony if we find out that anyone is doing anything, whether it's a badge or saying or doing anything, as this bill indicates, to injure or defraud other people with some semblance of their believing that that person is an officer, that we will enforce criminal action against those people in an effort to generally ensure that to the community that the people that are out there are in fact police and that they should comply with their orders. So those are my comments specifically to 547. I don't know if you want to comment on
Thank
that bill
you.
Before you move on to the next
very
one.
Much. And actually, you mentioned that you tie it to commission of an offense, which is good. But I remember Senator Prudensky saying, and maybe you'd like to answer this, Senator Prudensky, the definition or the situation where a police officer might feel that they have backup when they don't.
The situation I give to the committee, there was a situation where the Eugene Police, they have a contract with the University of Oregon to provide a type of service, and it's basically the police service. The campus has campus security officers. Mm-hmm. It is unfortunate that the campus security officers' uniforms are exactly identical to the Eugene Police officers' uniforms, as well as the badge is actually the same configuration. There was a situation where we had one of the police commissioners was riding with one of the officers, and they felt they were actually observed where there were what they thought they had a perimeter set on a building, and it turned out that it wasn't another Eugene police officer, but instead one of the security officers. And of course, there's a means of communication and et cetera, and sometimes the same assumptions are made. They have someone that is trained, qualified to take whatever actions may be necessary, when in fact that wasn't the case. We've had on that same campus situation where individuals have approached security agents thinking that they're reaching out or accepting or going to a police officer when in fact they weren't. And we're working with the University of Oregon regarding that issue, but this brought, I guess, really the bigger picture of how the statute currently is written and the concern in my discussions with Trooper Swift and others is to taking this out of the context of what the commission was experiencing or made aware of, but myself as a prosecutor knowing what happens out in the field and wanting to make certain, as we've heard from the deputy district attorney, how important it is to make certain there is a confidence in the general public that they are actually dealing with a sworn officer.
But as I look at the Hand and Gross version, I don't see that situation. I mean, what would the practical effect be on the University of Oregon security people, because they're not trying to injure or defraud, they're just standing there?
That's right. This per se is not going to deal with this. This again really brought to the issue, the larger issue of what was out in the community. We are still working on with the university on a, let's call it a one-to-one community to university level, but this was something that manifests from that, and we do believe that this will, in fact, assist in other ways where you may have people who could be in some other type of clothing uniform, such as a private security, who are trying to actually get benefit or injure or defraud somebody based on how they're dressed.
I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Swift. I am a state trooper for the state of Oregon. I'm also currently employed as the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The OSPOA represents the rank and file state troopers, forensic scientists, and telecommunicators that provide basically basic law enforcement services to the citizenry. The OSPOA is strongly in support of Senate Bill 547, principally for the issue of confusion in the mind of the public. And when I say that, the interaction between the police and the public on a routine basis relies tremendously on amount of trust on both parts. The law requires the citizenry to lawfully submit to and cooperate with law enforcement that's lawfully exerting its authority. The majority of citizenry does that. When they do not, a small percentage doesn't cooperate with us, and we will probably go into a defensive mode when that happens. When the public does submit, it puts them in a position of extreme vulnerability, that the person, in fact, and they're trusting that the person stopping is, in fact, a real law enforcement officer, and that is their protection. If that trust is ever gone, then we're going to have problems with that, both because they're going to react in a way that I don't know this is the officer, so they're not going to cooperate, and our defense mechanisms are going to kick in because we're trained if people aren't cooperating. There's a reason for that. So what this bill does, it allows very strict and punitive punishments for people who are trying to take advantage of that trust. And that's the purpose of this bill. In terms of what type of uniforms people are wearing simply for wearing them, that'd probably be a different bill for a different form if you want to regulate what type of uniform security guards could and could not wear. This is targeted strictly at the person who wants to take advantage of the trust the public has in their law enforcement and abuse it and put them at an extreme disadvantage. So our opinion is that absolutely, we've had people impersonate state troopers out on the road and stop cars, try to pretend they're police officers. The public needs to know that if a person is out there doing that for whatever reason, most often for nefarious reasons, but they're going to go to jail, and they're going to go to jail for a long time. The state takes such infringement upon that trust very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Do you want to cover Senate Bill 548 at the same time?
Wait,
before we go there, while we're still on 547, I assume you've looked at the Dash 1 amendments, and you're talking about the bill as it would be amended by the Dash 1 amendments?
Madam Chair, I have, yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, on to 548.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 548 is a bill that actually the District Attorney Association strongly endorses. This is a situation, as was previously mentioned by counsel. This referenced a statute, ORS 162-247, which actually is utilized by police officers very frequently out in the field. Police officers in the midst of a criminal investigation are limited in their tools when dealing with other people than the suspect that they are dealing with, and how to make themselves safe, make other citizens safe, and to be able to have an effective investigation. The officers are only allowed to, if they have probable cause, to arrest the person that they're dealing with, and then there may be other people out there that are causing undue hardship and potentially a very dangerous and escalating situation. So originally this bill, ORS 162-247 was passed. There was two subsections to that bill. One was dealing with whether or not it said that specifically the defendant could be prosecuted for, a person prosecuted for refusing to obey a lawful order by a peace officer. That has been determined recently by the case of State versus Illig Wren to be that subsection of the statute to be unconstitutional on an overbreadth analysis, indicating that too many things that are not specifically criminal or could be referencing the constitutional right to free speech, free public association, to be able to assemble peaceably in a potentially a political manner, that those things all potentially could get wrapped up into what a peace officer could arrest somebody for. Therefore, the Court of Appeals determined that that was unconstitutional. So the first part of this bill is to just remove that from the statute, since that's now determined to be unconstitutional. The Dash 1 amendments have added some additional subsections. The District Attorney Association is very much in favor of these amendments because, in fact, they add back the purposes for which the association believes that that original statute, the original subsection of the statute indicating that a person had to obey a lawful order. These are the kind of orders that we believe was either the intent or what needs to be the intent. And those are dealing with crime scenes and dealing with an officer investigating a situation and being able to deal with either that person themselves or other people that are making it difficult or impossible for the officer to be able to investigate safely. This would be a way that would the association's opinion is that would overcome the constitutional concerns that the court has, because it's now taken an overbreadth analysis and made it more narrow. And so it cannot be construed that a peace officer could arrest somebody for doing something else that was beyond the scope of their constitutional right to free speech and peaceable assembly. So we would strongly encourage the passing of this Senate bill.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Senator Pozanski, did you want to put something on the record here?
I do. I think I'll let Swift go ahead and finish his testimony, then I can just cover that one part.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the OSPOA strongly also supports this bill and the amendments that have been included. This is an incredibly important tool for law enforcement, because when we are, especially for emergency services, we're dealing with emergency scenes. We have to be able to control those scenes. We have to have something that will allow us to control third parties that want to interfere, sometimes maliciously, sometimes through misguided concern. One of the examples I have is a state trooper. We work often by ourselves. I've gone to traffic collisions in remote areas of the state where I'm the only law enforcement officer. Especially in the traffic collisions, we will have multiple family members show up at a traffic collision scene out of concern for their loved ones or for other reasons, but they will interfere, they'll get in the scene, and I cannot do my job if I'm having to deal with them. This passage of this would allow me in a controlled situation to lawfully exclude people from that scene with the power of arrest if they don't take the hint and let me do my job. The OSPOA strongly supports this, and we would also publicly like to thank Senator Pozanski, who I've worked with on these last two additions to this bill, and we genuinely appreciate his support on this.
How do you define a crime scene?
Crime scene would be anything that we're investigating where criminal activity has occurred. In most cases, it's usually going to be roped off by either crime scene tape or police cars where we're closing off intersections where we're conducting our investigative authorities or lawfully exerting governmental authority or control over that immediate area, person, or things that need to be controlled in an emergency situation.
So basically, you make that on the scene on a case-by-case basis?
Yes. When we show up at a scene, we don't know how big or how small it is. And in fact, you know, we sometimes expand them, sometimes we close them down, depending on how big they are. But we don't know until we get there what we have and what we're facing.
Okay. Senator Fasansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one thing that unfortunately was dropped, and again, I take responsibility for this because I try to push this through, and I really thank LC for getting the dash ones out on this. But one part that we wanted to include was really dealing with what the court said, and what my whole intention was when this bill passed back in its original form back, I think it's again like 97, and that's making sure that individuals who are advocating or using their constitutional protected rights and working within that they are safeguarded. So the only thing that needed to be added, when you look at the bill itself as it's been amended, I'm looking at the Hammond Gross bill so we can all be on the same one. When you look at the line 14 and it has the B, and it talks about, let's make sure I got that right. Nope, that's not right.
Line 14.
No, it's not line. That's wrong bill.
It's line 9B.
It's wrong bill. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
I was at 547. It will be line 9. Mm-hmm. It's going down to line 13. Line 13 where it says sub B, passive resistance. What we're proposing will have a dash 2 amendment, and it will say or, and then it will be a sub C, and it will be solely in constitutionally protected activity. Again, what we want to make certain is we address the concern that court said that if someone is engaged in a lawful assembly to do a protest, that they are not going to be caught up in this. If an officer says, you need to step back, and if they're constitutionally doing their right of assembly and having a public political demonstration, so long as they're not violating the law, they could not be forced to, let's say, not do a sit-in. That's the, I think, some of the concerns the court had in saying that the original language that was refused to obey a lawful order of a peace officer was too broad, too vague.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that we don't need some more work on the vagueness. We've got the crime scene, which is, it's pretty broad. It's basically what you say it is. And then the investigation of a crime, lawfully engaged in the investigation of a crime, that could be a matter of opinion too, whether you're investigating, you know, how does somebody know that you're investigating, because there are penalties.
With all due respect, Madam Chair, when we're exerting our lawful, and again, this is designed for the third person who is getting involved in this. If I am focused on the subject of a investigation, at the point, if they're free to leave, they're free to leave. If they're not, then they're detained, and it's either for violation or criminal activity is occurring. This is to prevent third person from getting involved in that criminal activity, so I have a tool to warn them, because that's not the person I want to deal with. I want to deal with the person who's the focus of my investigation. This is just a way to exclude them. And crime scenes, actually, while they sound vague, are fairly well defined. You've either got crime scene tape or police officers or police cars or something blocking off an area, preventing people from traversing where they would normally go. Shooting in downtown Portland, you may close off two sets of sidewalks. But the crime scene, once it's established, is fairly well established. And the whole idea is to keep people out of what we've determined, here are the lines, do not cross these lines until we're done with our job. We're not trying to throw a crime scene around the city of Portland or the city of Eugene during protest marches or anything like that. That's certainly not the purpose of this.
But Senator Fasansky.
And Madam Chair, I think the thing is, the concern I'm hearing you say, these officers are going to be telling this third person, I'm involved in an investigation, I need you to step back. Mm-hmm. That's the notice that he or she is doing their law or doing their duty, when as long as they're doing their duty lawfully, if that person continues to interfere, the best example I can give you is where you have an officer, let's say there's a DUI stop. The officer stops the person. He is or she is putting that individual through the field sobriety test. You have someone that steps off the curb and starts walking toward them. The officer has to divert their attention from watching the person perform the test to turn and deal with this person. And that's what's covered, you know, like say, in the main part of the bill. Then when you get into these crime scene, designated crime scene area, there's going to be an affirmative duty by law enforcement to designate the area. They just can't say it's 3 square miles. You know, they're going to have to somehow let people know what that is. So, as you would say, we're not ignorant of knowing that we're violating something without knowing it.
That's correct. And my concern is no one is going to argue with the intent of this, that, you know, when someone's investigating a crime, that's your job, and public safety is jeopardized if you're not able to do your job. No one's arguing with that. But I want to make sure that in certain cases that we don't interfere with people's rights to protest or to be in places where the crime scene investigation, you know, where they're not truly interfering with a crime scene investigation. I just want to make sure that the words do what we all agree should be done.
Madam Chair, I don't know if this will help, but if you take this as to what it should be, maybe not being in context with the rest of the amendment, but here it shows where these provisions do not apply.
Correct.
And there's two that are currently where they don't apply, an activity that would constitute resisting arrest because there's issues there. Also, passive resistance, that's where you have to sit down, or someone that just goes limp during a protest and refuses to walk with the officer, that you wouldn't use that on for enforcement, or solely in the constitutionally protected activity. And that's really just the part of what the court, I think, was saying. As your concern was my concern when I first brought this bill out in 97, we don't want to somehow give the government, in this case through law enforcement, the ability to limit our constitutionally protected rights.
Correct. And Senator Przanski is reading to me from a document that I had not seen before this hearing, and I appreciate you putting
that's the answer. I apologize. I didn't make it clear enough that or we wouldn't maybe have this discussion because it would have been the dash ones.
Correct. Chair Burdick, if I can just add one comment to what you've indicated. The concern is that people are going to inadvertently potentially go into these areas and without knowing that's what they're doing. And this crime, as do all crimes, require a mental state, and the mental state in this crime is intentionally or knowingly. So for the state to be able to prove, or a peace officer to even have probable cause to arrest, they would have to show that the person did it on purpose, that they intended to do it or they did it knowingly. And the only way that they could intend to do it or do it knowingly is if they had been informed. And that, and oftentimes, and I'm sure that the officer would testify as such, you know, peace officers say, they will warn someone time and time and time again. Oftentimes these people are intoxicated or on drugs or are being extremely hostile or belligerent, and so then they, after they've been warned and it's been documented, then they continue their behavior. Also following up on Senator Przanski's comments, just keep in mind that the other subsection of the statute was not found to be unconstitutional, and the wording of that was that a person intentionally acts in a manner that prevents or attempts to prevent a peace officer from performing lawful duties of the peace officer in regards to another person, which in itself is, on the face of it, when you hear it, is rather, I mean, just from the layman's terms, is rather vague. But the court did not find that to be overly overbroad or to be too vague to be found to be unconstitutional. And so when thinking about how narrow do we need to draft these amendments, the amendments that have been drafted are already much more narrow than the part of the statute that was left to be constitutional. The concern really is just the issue of the peaceable assembly, and that the association believes that the wording doesn't leave the ability to misconstrue that's how that could be a prohibition.
Well, I appreciate this discussion and Senator Przanski's and you all's elucidation, because if this ever gets to be an issue, the court will have something to look at to definitely determine our intent. So are there other questions or comments from the committee? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 547 and 548, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 547. Senator Starr, you were out of the room for part of this discussion. We like this bill a great deal, but if you don't feel comfortable making a motion on the Dash 1 amendment, I'm sure Senator Pozanski would be happy to.
Would you allow him to do so?
Senator Pozanski, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 into Senate Bill 547.
Senator Pozanski has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 547. Is there discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Pozanski.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 547 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pozanski has moved Senate Bill 547 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Are there objections? So ordered.
Certainly.
would you like to carry it, Senator Pozanski? Okay, at this time we will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 9, or we will open a work session on Senate Bill 921, and we will move Senate Bill 921, unless we already did and I forgot. We will move Senate Bill 921 to Monday's agenda to take up again. And now we will close the work session on Senate Bill 921. I believe that completes our agenda, unless anybody has any other parting comments. And Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Thank you. We'll get that other stuff.